Thank you. Be seated.
The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioners in Archer versus Transportation Insurance.
May it please the court, Mr. David Keltner will present argument for petitioners. He has reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
If it please the court, this is an insurance bad faith case that is brought by Carlson and Donna Archer against CNA for damages arising out of the wrongful delay and denial of workers' compensation benefits. There are several things that are not at issue here, and you need to know it. First of all, CNA does not complain in this court that the award to Mr. Archer is improper in any way, and in fact raises no points of error at all on the bad faith cause of action as to Mr. Archer.
What is the status of his claim?
Your Honor, his claim was originally delayed and then denied. It was subsequently tried to a final judgment, and
right.
That judgment is now final.
It is final, and is it appealed to the Court of Appeals?
I do not believe it was appealed.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir. The Court of Appeals reversed the judgment on the bad faith cause of action primarily based on Mrs. Archer's causes of action, and that's really what we're here today on. I think that both parties would admit that there are three separate issues before the court that we need to talk about today. First, whether Donna Archer had standing, any standing at all to bring any claim, whether she had pled and obtained findings on loss of consortium or familial interference. Second, whether she was able to plead and prove a cause of action for mental anguish damages that was derivative of her husband's claim. And third, whether the award of punitive damages was flawed. Now, after telling you that, I must admit to you that the parties don't agree on anything else. We don't agree what the Court of Appeals opinion says. We don't agree truly what the judgment is. And we don't even agree on the facts completely. Now, let me try to lessen some of that controversy with you, if I might, by admitting a couple of things. On page 2 of their brief in footnote 1, they say, quite frankly, and accuse us of manufacturing facts. I think there are two things I do want to tell you we are wrong on two items I want to fess up to. First, at footnote 1, they say that that we make the claim that CNA knew that the independent medical examiner that they requested claimed that this was a 100% functional disability of Mr. Archer's knee. We do say that in the brief. That is not completely accurate, and the fault is in clearly mine. What is true, what is in the record at pages 621 through 623, is that Dr. Capello, that doctor, did reach that conclusion, but he never told CNA about it because they did not ask him about it. I think that supports our cause of action even greater than is in our brief. Second on that page, they also say that we misquote their pre-hearing examiner. I quite frankly disagree with that a little bit. I think the quote probably is more accurate of saying that their pre-hearing officer told the pre-hearing examiner that there was no medical in the file that said he couldn't work, rather than it was not a compensable claim. That fault is mine, and I wanted to tell you of those. I think both those support our claims. Let me talk first, if I can, about the loss of consortium or loss of familial relationship cause of action. The Court of Appeals reaches its conclusion on this point in three separate ways. First, they said that we did not plead it. Second, they say that Donna does not have standing for it. Now, let me be honest with you and tell you that CNA claims that none of the holding is based on the standing issue. I find that a curious argument, since their first points of error in the court below, in the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, was that she had no standing and had to, in order to recover any kind of loss of consortium damage, establish a breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing as to her, and she could not recover derivatively through her husband's cause of action. That is in the Court of Appeals opinion, and it is clearly wrong. and violates this court's opinion in Willacy. In Willacy, this court held, and I think is absolutely right, that both loss of consortium and familial interference items are measures of damage. They are not causes of action, and they are derivative of the impaired spouse's cause of action. And again, let me tell you that this was clearly briefed in its entirety before the Court of Appeals, and I think the Court of Appeals reached this erroneous conclusion on the urging of CNA. Secondly, they say that we didn't plead it, and the Court of Appeals also reaches that conclusion. I think that's also wrong. I must confess to you that the pleading in this case, and we've done so in the brief as well, is for familial interference that was caused to Carlson and Donna Archer. It does not say loss of consortium, and we admit that, but I don't think it needs to. As this court in Willacy held, loss of consortium is the primary familial interest recognized and protected by the Texas courts. Again, Willacy says that the cause of action that is pled is the cause of action that is recognized to the impaired spouse and the deprived spouse of loss of familial interest or loss of consortium, if you will, has a derivative cause of action. No one has claimed, even to this day, that the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing was as to Mr. Archer was not pled. There were also no special exceptions. That is not dealt with the Court of Appeals opinion, and I would tell you that the Court of Appeals opinion is contrary to this court's opinions in a number of cases and also to Rule 45. Notice of the cause of action was clearly given because it was specifically pled. Notice of the damages was clearly given because it was specifically pled. Now, they claim that we didn't say consortium, and they're absolutely right. But we don't have to. In Rourke versus Allen, this court held in a negligence per se case that the term negligence did not even need to be mentioned, and no magic words were ever necessary in pleadings, and I think that's the case. Now, they also say that we did not obtain the right findings. And let me tell you that we did obtain a finding on familial interference, not on loss of consortium. They claim that that's not good enough. Our claim is, yes, it is, especially under the facts of this case. They knew that loss of consortium was what we were pleading. They objected to the court's charge based on that. They also made, I think, the objection that that was not a cause of action that was recognized in Texas. They sought an instruction that, although faulty, was directly to loss of consortium damages. They don't complain on this appeal of the failure to give that instruction. And I think based on that, the cause of action for loss of consortium or familiar interference survives. Now, let me tell you that they also make several other claims. They claim that we have to prove independent causation. They also prove that they have abandoned at the Court of Appeals level that we needed to prove a breach of the duty of good faith and dealing as to Donna Archer. That is not here before you today, although that is in the Court of Appeals opinion, and we disagree with that. But let me tell you, they also say that we have to prove proximate cause. That's not what this court said in Willacy, which said that resulting is good enough because, remember, you've already proved the causation element in the original cause of action. And this being a derivative damage, there's no need to do that. They also say one other thing that fascinates me. They say that the Court of Appeals held that we didn't prove our right to loss of consortium. That is clearly false. I don't find any place in the Court of Appeals opinion where the Court of Appeals said we failed to prove loss of consortium or familial interference. Now, the court does find that we failed to prove male anguish damages. And it says so specifically. But the court doesn't say that. They just made it on a pleading and finding element on the others. So I don't think that that works.
If Reagan against Vaughn is the exclusive rule pertaining to mental anguish, then you lose.
Yes, sir. No doubt about that.
Why isn't it the exclusive rule?
I don't think it is. This court in Reagan versus Vaughn, and I know that in one respect, and forgive me for using this term, is a hard-fought decision on the court. In Reagan versus Vaughn, we were dealing with the situation where the court picked up and I think properly so, from an earlier decision, the bystander situation. I hope the court at least did not mean in that instance that that's the only way mental anguish damages could be obtained. That would conflict with this court's opinions in Sanchez, in Lillibo, and other decisions, I believe. I recognize, and I think all of us recognize, that there needs to be some check on mental anguish damages. And representing defendants as well as plaintiffs, business interest as well as personal injury interest, I think that's true. But having that kind of standard that would only allow you to get mental anguish damages in one kind of case makes no sense, especially in this case when you consider that this was an intentional act, a tort found to be done intentionally over a long period of time that directly affected the community interest. Workers' compensation benefits, because they are of their nature a community type of interest, would directly affect Donna Archer as well as Carlson Archer. As a result, and let me say that we have conceded throughout this case, and even to the trial court, and certainly to the Court of Appeals, that if Reagan versus Vaughn is the sole avenue, we lose this issue on mental anguish damages. But we don't believe it is, nor should be. And that is the argument that we made to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals decision, I must tell you, says something a tad different. I think the briefs will bear that out.
Let me ask you.
Yes, sir.
Also, about you used these terms, loss of consortium and familial interference,
yes,
as if they were interchangeable. I'm not familiar with the term familial interference. Is it a term that's been used by any court in Texas?
I sort of got into two things there, Your Honor. Let me explain. Familial interference or familial relationship is a term that comes from Willitsy and also from the restatement. And that's where the loss of consortium comes. I have probably added my own interpretation to that as well. My light is on. Let me simply say that we will...
Any other questions?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Andrew Shapiro will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Shapiro. I represent the respondents in the state to whom I refer collectively as CNA. Donna Archer, in this case, as a matter of law, is not entitled to either actual or punitive damages. Because she recovered an undivided portion of the $5 million in punitive damages that the jury awarded, the entire award is tainted and must be reversed for a new trial. There are really two broad issues that before the court.
CNA says it's not contesting any award to Mr. Archer. How much money is that? That's just the comp portion of the award, or is there some?
No, the comp. Actually, Your Honor, the comp portion of the case is entirely separate.
Okay.
Only the bad faith trial.
There were some mental anguish damages, et cetera, related to bad faith.
That's right.
Not contesting, but they haven't been paid yet, I guess.
The comp award has been paid.
The comp's been paid, but no bad faith.
That's true. All of the bad faith damages are still before this court, and as the Court of Appeals reversed.
But he had some bad faith damages also?
Yes, he did, Your Honor.
And those haven't been appealed?
We did not contest those damages on appeal. We chose to contest the other portions of the award that we think are make the entire award fatally defective. The two broad issues that are before this court based on the Archer's points of error relate to Donna's actual damage recovery of mental anguish damages, and then something called interference with family relationships. It's very important. That's what the jury knew this to be. They didn't know it to be loss of consortium. And frankly, Your Honor, they didn't even know it to be familial interference. It was phrased in the jury charge as interference with family relationships. If you read the Archer's briefs and you listen to the Archer's arguments in the Court of Appeals and in this court, you would want to open up the jury charge and see a line for loss of consortium. You'd expect that it would be there. It's not there. What's there is something called interference with family relationships. And this court's analysis gets wrong.
How does that differ from loss of consortium?
In several ways, Your Honor. First, the issue itself is framed in the plural. It's called interference with family relationships, not interference with family relationships. So it has to be referring to at least more than one relationship. The only marital relationship Mr. and Mrs. Archer had, obviously, is a single relationship. That's one reason. The other reason...
CNA objects to these instruction that was offered to define family relationships?
Actually, we tendered the only instruction that was offered to define interference with family relationships. The Archers objected to that, and the court refused to give it to the jury. So the jury was left with absolutely no clue as to what this term meant. The only thing they could glean from it, frankly, is the fact that it was in the plural and that it related to at least more than one relationship.
And you have no complaint in this court concerning the failure to give that definition?
Yes, we do, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals sustained our point of error number 4, which said that the Archers failed to submit and obtain a finding necessary to recover for loss of consortium. Our whole point is this is not a loss of consortium finding. If you look at the words and you take all reasonable inferences from those words, it simply isn't a loss of consortium finding. The fact that the Court of Appeals refused to give our properly tendered instruction as to define it in terms of the elements of consortium proves beyond dispute that it wasn't loss of consortium.
If your definition had been given, same result, would you be here today?
Your Honor, we may well be here today, but we would not have the strength of the arguments that we have today.
Would there be any problem with the jury finding if your definition had been given?
I think that there would be a slighter problem, Your Honor, but I would have to concede there would be a much slighter problem. Now, with respect to what was going on here, I submit that there are other factors the court could look at if it needed to determine that this is not a loss of consortium finding, and the jury awarded damages for something other than loss of consortium. The first issue, obviously, is the instruction. The second issue is the fact that the Archers put on evidence of other family relationships. The jury, given the given the instruction that they had and given the issue, very well could have, and one might even say that they must have, awarded some damages for other family relationships. So our whole point on this is that this Jekyll and Hyde approach that the Archers have adopted to the loss of consortium, never mentioning it in their pleading, not allowing the instruction to go to the jury, not putting the issue in terms of loss of consortium, and then after trial, contending that it is somehow a loss of consortium award.
Was there any evidence in the case about any other relationships being interfered with?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is there any question the jury was considering other relationships based on what was introduced as evidence at the trial?
All I can tell you, Your Honor, is that at the trial there was evidence introduced about Mrs. Archer's relationships with her children and some of the things that her children did in the context of the period during which CNA and Mr. Archer had disputed about the matter. So that evidence was clearly before the jury, and it's noted in our response to their writ of error. There are several other reasons, even if the court were to find that this is somehow a loss of consortium recovery, there are several other reasons why the recovery must fail. The first is that there was no evidence of loss of consortium in this case. And now I'm speaking specifically of the damage to the marital relationship itself. There's exactly, and I counted them, there are about 33 words, may have missed one or two, in the entire 2,600-plus page statement of facts that relate to the Archers' marital relationship, and they're found at page 1832 of the statement of facts. It's Mrs. Archer's testimony, and even that evidence, to the extent it constitutes any evidence at all, is no more than a mere surmise or suspicion, and therefore is legally insufficient to support an award. It's true that we argued in the Court of Appeals that Mrs. Archer had no standing to assert a direct cause of action for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. However, the Court of Appeals' point of error sustained on that is merely that she is not in the position that Aranda put Mr. Archer in with respect to the insurance company. She had no right to assert a direct claim.
Is that your position today?
It's our position that she had no position to assert a direct claim for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing.
So, for example, if instead of loss of consortium, she had a death claim and she were a widow, she would have absolutely no right of any kind as far as good faith and fair dealing to expect in a relationship with the insurance carrier.
No, Your Honor, I think in that situation, I'm not an expert in the workers' comp statutes, but I think in that situation, in a death claim, there are certain claims that would have been Mr. Archer's that would go to his widow. So I don't believe that I would state it quite the way you did.
So the protection afforded by Aranda, you believe, is available to a widow in a workers' compensation claim, but not available to merely the wife of someone who's been maimed?
Your Honor, all I meant to say was that I'm not certain whether or not ARENDA protection would extend in a death situation to a widow. What I do know is that the ARENDA analysis and the analysis of all courts following ARENDA has been that the insured is the one to whom the insurance company, the insured being the injured employee, is the only one to which the insurance company owes a duty of good faith and fair dealing. But
Mr. Shapiro, are you saying that a wife or a spouse cannot get loss of consortium damages for a breach of good faith and fair dealing to the covered spouse?
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor.
In this case, CNA is not contesting the finding of liability of breach of good faith and fair dealing to Mr. Archer.
In this case, that's true. We are not contesting
in the honest appeal. Then how do we get in this argument about whether or not she has a direct claim or doesn't have a direct claim?
There is no argument, Your Honor. My colleague raised it as a basis for the Court of Appeals' opinion. Our position is it has nothing to do with the proper result in this case, but that the Court of Appeals' ruling was a correct statement of the law, that she has no direct claim.
If we conclude that the question of familial interference was a substantially correct wording of the question to the jury, and they answered $2,500, then that's the end of your case, isn't it?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor, because we've argued that there's no evidence to support that award. We've argued that there was a lack of another finding that was necessary to support that award, the lack of a proximate cause finding. And we've also argued...
But proximate cause only is relevant if you're talking about a direct action, isn't it? You've already conceded that you are liable for bad faith or the conduct toward Mr. Archer, that there is not a direct action, that consortium is just derivative. So it doesn't just fall in the place of the fact that if there is evidence supporting loss of consortium, we find the instruction correctly, we don't reach a question about needing to submit proximate cause.
Your Honor, I think it still would be necessary to reach it, frankly, because the proximate cause element of Mr. Archer's damages has nothing to do with whether or not Mrs. Archer's damages, derivatively sought, were proximately caused by CNA's actions. And if Mrs. Archer is going to elect a recovery under a breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing derivative suit, then she should be held to the same causation standard that Mr. Archer is. It doesn't make any sense to allow a lesser standard when you're getting further afield from this special relationship that ARENDA created and allow her to recover without the need to get a jury to find that the damages were proximately caused and that there was foreseeability. So I would still contend that it would be necessary for Mrs. Archer to obtain a separate proximate cause finding if her cause of action derivatively requires the proximate cause for damages to be allowed. If I may move on to the mental anguish damages. Mrs. Archer has recovered for mental anguish damages in this case. And as the court has recognized, if Reagan controls the case, then she's not entitled to that recovery.
Didn't our discussion in Boyles pretty much negate any claim that these damages have to be controlled by Reagan and Vaughn?
Your Honor, I believe that the discussion in Boyles centered, while it was an affirmation of the bystander rule, it also centered on a separate cause of action.
Right, but it recognized and reaffirmed Moore and Millibaugh and Sanchez and Schindler and other cases that recognize other means by which mental anguish can be obtained if it's appended to an appropriate tort.
Your Honor, those cases all dealt with the direct situation. They did not deal with a derivative situation. I think that those cases might be more applicable to an argument about whether or not Mr. Archer was entitled to mental anguish damages. But in this case, Mrs. Archer is the one who's recovering. Mrs. Archer has admitted that no tort was committed as to her. Mrs. Archer got no findings that any tort was committed as to her, and she hasn't contended it on appeal. She's trying to recover derivatively based on the tort committed against another. The only way under Texas law that mental anguish damages are allowable in that situation without some sort of statutory guidance is for Mrs. Archer to be a bystander under the rule set forth in Reagan and followed by this court since the case of Freeman in 1988. It would require a repudiation of Reagan and a substantial portion of the discussion in Boyles as well to find that Mrs. Archer is entitled to mental anguish damages in this case, because you couldn't allow her to recover here when a bystander who happens to come upon the scene of a terrible accident just a few minutes after it happened is denied recovery. That would be an anomaly in the law, and it would basically be eliminating the bystander rule in Texas. So those, we think that those, for those reasons, it would be unnecessary, and frankly, very difficult to, it's very difficult to determine what line Mrs. Archer contends that the court should now draw. If it were to eliminate the bystander rule, it's not at all clear where she says the new line should stand. The California experience in this case, is instructive in that they have really agonized over where you draw the line. It's clear, and my colleague noted it, it's clear that a line needs to be drawn somewhere, because the burden of allowing derivative mental anguish claims to piggyback on top of every tort would be crushing. The Archers make no new test, have not suggested how she can recover in this case. She has no independent cause of action, and the only derivative way she can recover is as a bystander under Texas law. It's what her argument amounts to is little more than an unprincipled wish that she be entitled to keep her recovery in this case, and that doesn't constitute a sound basis for changing what has been existing Texas law for some time. If I may now address the punitive damage aspect of this case, it's beyond dispute that if Donna Archer...
Excuse me, before you get into that in full, I know that part of that argument relates to the citation to the new Workers' Compensation Act. And my question to you before we get into that argument is, are there any other changes that were made in the new Workers' Compensation Act that bear on this case? Or put another way, will a decision in this case have any effect under the new Workers' Compensation Act other than on this punitive damages question?
Your Honor, first, with respect to the first part of your question, we've not contended that the new Workers' Compensation Act applies to this
right.
case.
I understand
so
that.
We argue that it's persuasive authority for the notion that the punitive damage award is excessive. as far as this Court's decision in this case, I'm not aware of, nor have the Archers cited any way that the decision in this case would affect the new Workers' Compensation Act. So my answer to that is I'm not aware of any. Now, with respect to punitive damages, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, will a decision here concerning Donna Archer's claim continue to be viable under the new Workers' Compensation Act?
Will a decision as to Mrs. Archer's claim?
Yes. Is it possible, will our writing here, is there anything in terms of limitations in the new Workers' Compensation Act that will cause any ruling made here, if it is a ruling that is adverse to your position, apply only to old law cases?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any. With respect to punitive damages, though, before you reach the common law and constitutional aspect of the punitive damage award, it's necessary to simply review the undisputed law in this jurisdiction that if Donna Archer doesn't recover actual damages, she's not entitled to recover punitive damages. The Archers have asserted in their brief somehow that she didn't recover any punitive damages, but that is clearly contradicted by the record. They not only submitted her name in question 13, which is the punitive damage question, but they moved for judgment in her favor, and the judgment was entered in her favor in the amount of $5 million along with her husband. The trial court award would entitle her to collect the entire sum. Their secondary argument, though, is that it doesn't matter that Donna Archer's name was submitted in the punitive damage question, that the punitive damage award can remain undisturbed even if this court determines that she's not entitled to any actual damages in this case. This contention is almost as outrageous as the first. The Archers insisted on submitting her in question 13, despite CNA's repeated objections during trial and during the charge conference that it was improper to give the jury any damages to Donna Archer. They also submitted an instruction to the jury that told the jury that it was to consider, among other things, the situations and sensibilities of the parties. This the court must presume that the jury followed the instructions that they were given and considered, to some extent, Donna Archer's situation and sensibilities when it determined what the amount of the punitive damage award should be. Now, when it suits their purpose, they want Donna to disappear from the equation, as if they can somehow know, or that anyone, frankly, at this point can somehow know, that the deliberation of her had nothing to do with the punitive damage award. That's simply not allowable under the law, and the undeniable truth is that no one knows, can anyone know that her inclusion had no effect on the punitive damage.
I'm a little bit confused. Talked about you not raising, or CNA does not challenge any awards to Mr. Archer, and then you say, but of course, now as to Mrs. Archer, we're challenging this punitive damage. Is Mr. Archer not before the court on appeal, or is Mr. Archer on the court? You've got a question that applies to Mr. Archer, and the question is, have you appealed that award for him, saying it's an impermissible award because it includes factors that are not properly included in the question?
We have. We've made a number of arguments as to the punitive damage award itself. Some of them relate solely to Donna Archer's inclusion in the award. Some of them relate wholly apart from Donna Archer's inclusion in the award.
So the record has Mr. Archer here for the purpose of appeal. You haven't.
That's true. But the award, the question and the award is joint. And it's impossible to pull Mr. or Mrs. Archer out of it. The only way the court can consider the award is to consider the award as a whole. And as a whole, it's defective for a number of different reasons, one of which is the taint of the inclusion of Mrs. Archer, who had no business being in the question at all. Another goes to the fact that there's no finding of CNA's mental state as to Mrs. Archer. In order for her to be entitled to recover punitive damages, there needs to be some finding that CNA had a mental state above the level or at or above the level of gross negligence as to her, and there is none in this case. That argument would apply whether or not she is in fact entitled to recover actual damages. The other arguments that we've made are noted in a brief, and I just want to touch on them briefly because my time is running out. But the first is that the court failed to instruct the jury, as it should have, that the punitive damage award needed to be reasonably proportional to the actual damage award. CNA tendered that instruction to the court, and the Archers objected, and the court refused to give it to the jury.
Can't the court take care of that on entry of judgment?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Can't the court take care of that on entry of judgment? Why does the jury have to consider that?
We think that the jury should consider it because Rule 277 says that if an instruction, that the court shall submit such instructions and definitions as are proper and enable the jury to render a verdict. In this and the technical clause is considered proper to mean that the instruction would assist the jury in its deliberations and is legally correct. The Archers have made no contention that either of those factors are not true, that the instruction would have assisted the jury or that it was somehow not legally correct. We think that the trial court's discretion in this matter is not completely unbridled. If the instruction is proper, it's a proper statement of law, and it would assist the jury, it should have been given. And in this case, it wasn't. I see that my time is up.
Are there any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Counsel, why did you object to CNA's definition of familial relationship?
Your Honor, I wasn't there, and
I
don't know that I can answer that. There are, to your satisfaction, in all fairness. First off, the record does not reflect it was objected to. It was certainly not given by the court, but a record of the charge conference, and it may or may not be the truth, Your Honor, I don't know. But I'll tell you that in the charge conference, I've looked for that, and unless I'm missing it, there is no indication of objection.
Of any objections or that objection?
Just that objection, Your Honor, only that objection.
Did trial counsel object to submitting the punitive damage issue separately?
No, ma'am. They did not. They made other objections, that some of which you just heard, but they certainly did not object as to that. And in fact, that was the subject, If you look at the motion for judgment in JNOV hearing, that was a topic of some discussion with the trial judge.
Are you saying that the charge conference record is not present?
No, sir. It's there. It's there. What I'm saying is there was certainly a tendered instruction. There is no indication of who objected to what in terms of tendering that instruction.
Instruction marked refused?
Yes, sir. It was. No doubt about that. And that part of the record is certainly preserved, and I don't mean to suggest otherwise.
And you agree that there is some evidence in the record of Mrs. Archer's relationship with other members of the family other than Mr. Archer?
Oh, Your Honor, no. And I don't for several reasons. This case, there was some evidence that naturally went to punitive damages about the effect that the decisions had had. And there was discussion about what the family was able to do and not do. But it certainly, I don't think, related to the relationships in a direct way.
You concede that under no state of the law would Mrs. Archer be entitled to damages for any interference with any relationship other than Mr. Archer because of the conduct?
Under the current state of Texas law, that is right. I think we all could make arguments about that, but that case, quite frankly, is not clearly before the court in the instant matter. They've talked a little bit about punitive damages, and I want to bring that up because I think there are a number of things that have been said and left unsaid about that issue in this case. First off, let me tell you what they didn't object to at the charge conference, what they didn't complain of later, because I think that's important. There are a number of allegations made here about punitive damages. There was not, as mentioned, any objection to separating out or joining together the punitive damage issue. There was a situation where there certainly was a finding of intentional wrongdoing that has not been appealed to this court and is not here.
Was there an attempt to show negligence and gross negligence also? Or was it purely
intentional? And was done so specifically, I think, but that is the way it reaches the case. This was an aggravated case, and I don't want to get too much in it because it really hasn't been touched on. This was a very aggravated case in terms of claims handling practice that showed it wasn't just done by an employee out on a lark, but was accepted by the management of CNA and also ratified, and I think that's very important. You'll see evidence in the record in our statement of facts in some detail about that. What happened was they delayed almost every payment made to a health care provider and admit that's wrong. They denied payment when they knew that they should have paid. And in their internal memorandum even amazingly say that we have appealed this case so we won't have to pay lifetime medical. And in fact, they're in the file, I mean, in the statement of facts, there is a system at that insurance company that benefits people who get settlements for less than lifetime medical, which is prevented by the Workers' Compensation Act as it existed at that time. In this case, they objected to a lot of things in the punitive damage charge, and you need to know about them because I think it affects their appeal. The Alamo versus Crouch standards were given in the punitive damage issue. They objected to all of those. And they said that should not have been given because it brought undue attention. They nonetheless at this court raised one of the points of error is the process does not meet with due process. But they didn't ask the court to give any other types of instructions except the proportionality instruction. And the proportionality instruction is extraordinarily important because it wasn't tendered in substantially correct form. They cite as their theory for that Justice Osborne's concurring opinion in the Zubiate case. And in Zubiate, that is not part of the majority opinion, but Justice Osborne, the fine Chief Justice of that court, does say maybe that's what you ought to do. But he says that it has got to go to specific damage issues. This didn't. But nonetheless, that, except for Justice Osborne's or Chief Justice Osborne's opinion, in the state of Texas is the only opinion that says that instruction ought to be given to the jury. Even Justice Kennedy at the Supreme Court in Haslip said that, in his opinion, this was one of the factors that had to be considered in reviewing the punitive damage award, not in instructing the jury. In heavens, how is that workable? Do you instruct the jury as to a specific issue and say, or is a standard of review for the trial court?
If Donna does not recover her 20, or her recovery is not upheld for her $2,500 for the loss or interference with the familial relationship, we don't need to get to any of that, do we?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And as far as that recovery, do you agree with the opposing counsel that the only evidence supporting that jury finding of $2,500 is 32 or 33 words that I think you referred to on one page of the statement of facts?
Your Honor, as we have put in our brief, there's more than that, but slightly more. But those are pretty powerful 33 words. They cite the Cruz case from Corpus Christi that discusses that in great detail. The difference between this case and Cruz, quite frankly, is in Cruz they weren't talking about any emotional injury. They were talking about loss of other kinds of things that are not, as a matter of law, recoverable. In this case, they talked about emotion and the problems with the relationship exactly. And that is enough in those situations. And I think there's no doubt that the evidence is there. Absolutely no doubt the evidence is there.
Counsel, Mr. Shapiro said that you admitted that no tort was committed as to her, as to Mrs. Archer. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not so sure it's true. The case wasn't submitted that way. I mean, there's no doubt that the case was submitted as this being a derivative cause of action under Willitsey. I think under the proper circumstance, and maybe even under the facts of this case, you could make a case that a direct tort was committed. But that is not the way this case was submitted, and that is not the way the case reaches this court.
Will this be the first time, if we adopt your position, that there's been recovery under Willitsey on a derivative action by the spouse for bad faith? I know you cite a couple of other cases, but they seem to kind of skirt the issue.
Your Honor, they do skirt the issue. And I was not able to find one at the time that briefing was done. I will need to admit to you one other thing. Due to the press of some family emergencies, I did not rebrief that before the argument in this case, and normally would have. But I must tell you that at that point, I could not find one. But I do not think that that is fatal at all to this, because certainly in other cases in which it was mere negligence and not an intentional thing, intentional type of tort, those things were alleged. You can make an argument. They have distinguished some of those cases, and I don't think those cases are distinguishable in terms of the tort in the derivative recovery. But I would have to admit that there certainly are cases that say the insurance code, you could have gotten this type of recovery.
What's your best, I know they're in your brief, but what's your best two or three cases that are most analogous?
Boy, Your Honor, I would have to look. I think that there are two things. The Birchfield case obviously discusses it in some detail. After Whittlesey, I know Torsha discusses it, although I would not have to say that Torsha is the best case, but it certainly does discuss it.
Has there been any briefing on the ability to make this kind of recovery derivatively in other states?
Your Honor, there has been. The interesting thing is, in many other cases, there is a direct cause of action depending upon what the essence of separate versus community property is. And I didn't want to get into that with the court, quite frankly, because that formed a basis of a lot of those decisions. I don't want to turn again to punitive. I'm sorry, my time is up.
Mike, any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Counsel. That concludes the argument in this cause. The foregoing two causes have now been submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will please adjourn the court.
Yes, please rise. Oh, yes.